Hello, you know who this is. You are listening to the Guitar Radio Show.
Wow! This episode of Guitar Radio Show is brought to you by Nico's USA Pickups. The quintessential pickup is finally here to capture the essence of the best vintage and modern tones on the planet. We all know there are certain periods that have captivated guitar players because of their cherished tones. Nico's USA pickups are handmade and designed to deliver just what you're looking for. Made in America, incorporating period-specific materials for the most discerning guitarist, the tone will easily captivate your ears with an amazing balance of highs, mids, and bass response, yielding unprecedented sound and feel. Authentic tones from authentic materials, handcrafted in the USA, Nico's USA Pickups. Go to nicosusapickups.com for more information. With a unique design and construction, DNA Guitars is a clear choice when looking for the all-around guitar. DNA Guitars' recipe for creating perfect instruments is steeped in tradition while looking toward the future. DNA's recessed bridge construction is a five-point contact bridge, a solid brass bridge that is inset into the body, maximizing strength, contact, and string vibration. An incredibly comfortable guitar to play, DNA Guitars molds to your body, and the neck profiles are wonderful to play across. DNA uses an exclusive 100% solderless wiring harness that is designed for guitars with single coil or humbucker setup. Looking for versatility? Look no more. Check out DNA Guitars. Go to dnaguitarcompany.com. Custom guitars handcrafted in the USA. DNA Guitars. Innovation to fuel your inspiration. Well, hello everybody and welcome to episode 100 of Guitar Radio Show. The show dedicated to all things guitar, dedicated to the guitar player, guitar builder, gear maker, and purveyors of such items that you may not know about, but you should. It is my pleasure to say I am your host, Mark Davin, and for 100 episodes, I have been here to bring you, hopefully, some interesting content in the world of guitar and gear and great guitar players, both known and unknown. For those of you who don't know, this show started as something that was pitched to Sirius XM back in 2007. Unfortunately, it did not work out. It was originally going to be called The Instrument on Sirius XM. It was going to be a 24-hour-a-day all-guitar channel. And who knows, someday maybe it'll be something somewhere doing just that. We'll see. But today's episode is to kind of chronicle what we've done over the last 3.5 years, almost 4 years of doing this show. And we're going to play some snippets of some of our favorites. And we went around and we asked a bunch of folks what they thought their favorites were. And we tried to put together a nice cross-section of all these different little snippets of interviews that we've had over the last 3.5 years. Before we go on, I'd like to thank everybody who's been involved with this show from the very beginning. Mr. Earl Grissom, Lefty Wright, Adam Hunt, thank you. Steve Cohn, thank you. Dave Jennings, Adam Steins, Al Gross, the folks at Killer Bee Guitars, the folks over at Screamin' Effects, and of course, our latest sponsors, Nico's USA Pickups and DNA Guitars. It is great to be involved with all of these folks and having these people contribute in the way that they do to the show. It's fantastic. And we have a blast doing it. And we never, ever thought that when we first started this show that 100 episodes later, we would be broadcasting in over 11 countries worldwide and having the listenership that we do. We're thrilled and very, very grateful. Folks, go to guitarradioshow.com for more over there. If you want to contact us, you can reach us at guitarradioshow@gmail.com. Please like our Facebook page, follow us on Twitter, Instagram, Tumblr, and of course Google Plus, which I don't mention nearly enough. When you do listen on any of those other places like iTunes or Stitcher Radio or Podbay or Podomatic, Player FM, Podbean, any of those places, please rate and review the show. We would be very grateful for that. But always go to guitarradioshow.com and check out the show notes, because that's where you'll find a lot more information about every single episode and that particular person that we're talking to that week. This show airs every Wednesday, and it will be for the foreseeable future. We love doing what we're doing, and we're going to keep doing it. We're going to get started. We'll play you little snippets from different episodes, and if it's something you haven't heard and it intrigues you, we'll let you know what episode number it is at the beginning of every cut, and if you want to go back, you can go and check it out. In the meantime, like I always like to say, let's get ready with the show. Business is out of the way. You ready? Guitar Radio Show. GuitarRadioShow.com. One of the game-changing moments for Guitar Radio Show was when we had the one and only Johnny Hyland on the show. Here's us talking about his gear and rig on episode 25.
So, you know, here at Guitar Radio Show, we're gear junkies, and going to your page, your gear page, johnnyhyland.net, was fantastic, because you get so much information and you are involved with so many fantastic companies. I mean, Ernie Ball Music Man Guitar is just the beginning of it all, and we dig deeper and deeper and deeper. Just before we went on the air, you had given me the information that on your page is a thing about Road Dogg amps, and I was really excited about it when I watched the video, and you had just given me some bad news. Why don't you tell the folks about that?
Well, I'll tell you what, man, the gear thing with me has been a true blessing in my life. I've got so many wonderful endorsers out there who've taken care of me over the years. And of course, there's so many, it would take up the whole show just me talking about my endorsers. I will say this, Music Man Guitars, folks, everyone's seen me out on the road doing clinics for Paul Reed Smith or for Fender or, you know, in the past. And, you know, you always hear the endorser that you're working for, you always, oh, well, that's the best thing in the world, you know. But I can truly tell you, Ernie Ball Music Man Guitars are the most comfortable guitar I've ever played in my whole life. I can assure you, man, if I probably had the chance to get into a Music Man when I started guitar, I probably would have never left. I probably would have played them my entire life. I'm truly blessed to be with Music Man. I truly love Sterling and the whole Music Man family, you know, Derek and all, everyone out there, truly the most amazing people, and have always taken great care of me. And and of course, I must tell you guys, for all you gearheads out there, I have some new Johnny Hyland pickups coming out with an awesome company up in Pennsylvania, and the company's called Electric City Pickups. Mr. Billy Mangella has worked with me to design essentially four new sets of pickups that cover Strats, Silhouettes, Telecasters, whether you have a Nashville-style Tele or a stock Tele, and, of course, humbuckers. And I've actually named all these in relationship to guns, because these pickups, folks, will spank you hard. So the pickups that are in my Music Man right now are called Johnny Hyland Six Shooter Singles. And for all you Strat players, you need to hear about them too, because they are awesome. They truly are amazing, and I'll tell you why. What we've done is we've taken the bridge pickup from like a 1949 Broadcaster, and we've designed a Strat-style set that are Strat, you know, they have the Strat contour, the Strat, you know, the slenderness of a Strat pickup. But yet the bridge pickup is based off a Telecaster pickup or an old Broadcaster pickup. So for all you Strat players who thought your Strat was a little too thin in the bridge, You need to try some Johnny Hyland 6-year singles. Now, the Telecaster set, those are called the 12-gauge Tele set, and those are actually pretty amazing pickups in their own right. Essentially, if you have a Nashville Telecaster, you basically get a 6-year single for the center. And then, of course, my humbuckers are called the double barrel buckers. So as you can hear, all three of them are related to guns, and trust me, they will spank y'all pretty good, and they're awesome. But go to electriccitypickups.com, tell Billy that Johnny Hyland sent you, and he'll take good care of you, I promise you.
That's great.
Now, the other thing I got to report to you guys is I have had my mind blown recently, within this past year, from learning about wiring harnesses in guitars. Now, folks, there's a company called Martin Six String Customs, MSSC, out of Pennsylvania again, that has created two new Johnny Hyland signature wiring harnesses for guitars. Mm. We have a Strat-style one and, of course, a master volume, master tone like my Silhouette. And I'll tell you what, guys, as a guitar player, I have never given any thought to the fact that a wiring harness could make the biggest difference in how optimized my tone really becomes. And I'll tell you, Martin Six String Customs, guys, they build the best harnesses in the world. Go to YouTube. You can pull up some of the videos I've done on YouTube. Or you can go to martinsixstringcustoms.com, or their other website is msscguitar.com, and check out all of the wiring harnesses. But just take my word for it. I guarantee you, you'll come on to info@johnnyhyland.net and thank me, because I guarantee you guys, it will change your life. It'll change the responsiveness of your guitar, how much fun you have when you play your guitar, and how addicted you'll be to your guitar, because you'll want to go back to it and just keep playing over and over again. Mm-hmm. So the wiring harnesses have made a big difference with me, guys, and I just want you to know about that as well. It's incredible.
That's great. I mean, you know, and we're always chasing tone, you know.
The bad news.
Yeah, the bad news. Go ahead.
I had a wonderful guy by the name of Craig Wildenrod design me a beautiful new Johnny Hyland signature amp called the Road Dog. And his company was called CEC Amplification. And the Road Dog, you can actually see videos of me playing on my website. And I was so proud of the amp. But unfortunately, folks, Craig has announced on Facebook that he has shut the doors to the company. And, of course, I guess we all know, that hard times don't seem to escape us all, you know. And I truly believe that Craig Wildenrod is one of the best amp designers I've ever heard in my lifetime. He built me an amp that is truly awesome. And I'm just sorry that you guys won't be able to get into one. But I will tell you on a lighter note, I've just been recently turned on to a new amp that's just come out. And I won't quite let you in on it fully, but it looks like there might be some kind of movement coming up real soon with me and another amp company. And I've teamed up with my buddy Cliff Coltrary to make this happen. So I'm really excited. Check out destroyallguitars.com. You'll see me on there before too long, I'm sure, supporting a new amp.
Well, that's exciting.
Yeah.
All right.
You know what? I'm on your show, Mark. I'll let people in on it. I'm actually going to be checking out real soon the new Reeves Space Cowboy.
Ooh.
By Reeves Amplification. They've got a new amp that Cliff called me about and said, Johnny, you would be mind blown over this amp, bud. So, I'm going to be checking it out real soon, and I'm really excited about it. And I just can't. As a matter of fact, I'll report to you, Mike, when I make the plunge, buddy. But that's really what's fixing to happen here in the near future.
Well, that's great. Thank you for the scoop on that. That's and great company too.
You got the scoop. You're getting the scoop right here first.
That's right. I love it. That's it. So what are you using as far as strings nowadays?
Oh, man, I've been an Elixir string boy for about 12 years now.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, I've been using Elixir 9 to 42s, and I love the nanos and the polywebs. I love both of them.
And you're a 9-gauge guy, huh?
Yes, I am. Yeah.
Same here.
I'll tell you what, guys. I have a huge acid content in my hands. And, you know, I truly can tell you elixir strains will last you. And I don't know if you've never tried elixir strains, you need to, because they're amazing. The tone is great. The feel is great.
Yeah.
They last a long time.
That's great.
Episode 93 found us in the clutches of the amazing mind of Mr. Greg Koch.
And recently I saw a really great video of you playing a 1953 Les Paul.
Yes.
And that thing was just amazing. And, you know, I know that there's, and share your opinion on this. I mean, you know, a lot of people say, oh, that guitar, it's this and that, and it's the amp. But there's the player too, the actual flesh on, you know, what does Billy Gibbons call it? Meat on metal on wood.
Yes.
Do you?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, gear, I always refer to it as 99% is in the person's hands.
Right.
Yeah, but that 1% is pretty important.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can tell, you know, people are always interested. Well, and believe me, I used to be very, before I started doing the videos for Wildwood, I was very suspicious of these guitars that were so expensive. Because when I was doing the Fender stuff, I mean, I have custom shop guitars, but for the most part, I played production line stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, that Telecaster I played for years was an American Deluxe Ash Telecaster. It was not a custom shop piece. It was just this relatively pedestrian production line guitar. So I was always very suspicious of this high-end stuff. And then I started working for doing those videos for Wildwood, and I would play all the different guitars. I'm like, oh, well, now I get it. Mm-hmm. And so there is a difference between a production line Fender, a custom shop Fender, and a difference between a master-built custom shop Fender versus all those other guitars. Same thing with Gibson. And you can really tell the difference in these higher-end versions. Having said that, unless you're comparing A being, it really doesn't matter all that much. The only thing it does, the only thing I'll say is, if you're a professional musician or you really want to represent your playing in the best possible way, knowing that there is a difference, you probably want to have something that enables you to get the best sound that you possibly can within the confines of what's reasonable in your financial situation. But that's not to say, I mean, Jack Pearson plays a Squire Strat through a Blues Deluxe amplifier, or a Blues Junior. Mm-hmm. You know, and a lot of people will say, well, see, you can do that with, yeah, but you know what? He would sound better with a custom shop. It's it's just a fact. You know what I'm saying? So musically, it doesn't really matter as far as the end result, but it does, you know, that 1% does enable you to sound a skosh better.
Yeah.
Well, does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely, for sure. I notice a difference. I mean, I have Mexican Strats, I have American Strats, and there is that I guess an echelon of change that you notice a difference in that. And I mean, quality and feel and sound. But then again, I've played some Squires, then I'd be like, this can't be a Squire. This has got to be at the very least a Mexican Strat or an American Strat.
Right.
So, you know, it's sometimes it's luck of the draw too.
That's true. Absolutely.
You know, so speaking of gear, since we're talking about gear, I saw you with a Strat at the Fishman demo at the Dallas show.
Yes.
Is that your main go-to?
Well, I was playing the Strat and the Les Paul. I've been helping Fishman now with these pickups, and I'm helping them design them and to market them. And And so we got the Strat pickups done and we got the humbuckers done. But part of the deal was that we were making a signature version of the Telecaster pickups for me. And those are going to be out October 1, I think, is what the goal is. So now that those Tele pickups are done, and I've got them on a Tele here, they are ridiculous. Mm-hmm. So I kind of see myself at this particular – I mean, the Telecaster is kind of my desert island with electricity guitar.
Yeah.
Just because it, I feel most free on a Telecaster in terms of, you know, there's a certain amount of, it's a blank canvas. I can kind of get those Strat-ish tones as far as that cool, everything that's cool about a Fender, as far as the bite and the squishiness of the neck pickup. But by the same token, you add a little, you know, gristle to it, and it's a rock machine if need mm-hmm. be. It's the blues machine, it's a country machine, it's a jazz. It can do everything I need it to do. Plus, you can treat it like a farm animal, and it's going to stay in tune. So, Telecaster is really my favorite guitar. Having said that, I've got a whole... You know how it is. I mean, you have a whole repertoire on an instrument, and I have a whole bunch of things that I do on a Strat that I've worked hard to kind of get my own little take on cool Strat nuance mm-hmm. styles and tunes and so on. Same thing with a Les Paul, same thing with a 335. So I kind of see in a perfect world that I play all those instruments, but if I'm doing a gig and I got to bring one guitar, I'm bringing the Tele at this point.
Right.
Prior to that, before those Tele pickups were done, I would bring the Strat in that regard, or the Les Paul. But I feel comfortable bringing any of those guitars. But it's funny because since I've been playing the Tele more now again, I'm realizing it's just like unchaining the beast. You know what I mean? there's things that I do on a Telecaster that I don't do on any other instrument.
On episode 51, we were lucky enough to meet up with Mr. Gary Hoey, and he walked us all the way through his rig.
So let's talk gear, man.
I'm kidding, man. I don't want to talk to you.
Let's talk gear. You're a Fender endorser, right?
Yes. I've been a Fender endorser now for 20 years. I've been playing Strat.
Wow.
Started out on a Les Paul, and then I was playing Hanger for about 8 years. I was with Hanger guitars, but now I've settled in with Fender, mm-hmm. off my Strat, and been using Seymour Duncan pickups for a long time. Lately, I started trying out these new pickups by Fishman called Fluent, which are their first electric guitar pickup called the Fluent pickup, and they're actually quite amazing. I've been using those, trying them out. My amp of choice is EVH, Eddie Van Halen 5153, which is the third installment of his 5150 amp. And the one I use is manufactured by Fender. And it's an amazing three-channel amp. I love it to death. I use it on my new blues record, so it does everything.
That's cool. And what do you use much in the way of pedals, or no?
Yeah, I do. I have a pedal board out on the road, and what I use is I'm using a tube streamer. I'm using my new distortion pedal called the Intimidator, which I designed with Rocktron. It's a little more of a hard rock, heavy metal type pedal. It has a lot of gain, but it can be used for anything. I use the Joe Satriani delay, the Vox, I think it's called the Time Delay or something, and Joe gave it to me. He personally gave me the delay. That's, you know, not why I use it, but it's an awesome delay pedal. And I use the Boss, I think it's called the Rev 5 or something. It's a reverb pedal. And I run both of those into my effects loop, which I think is extremely important. So my wah, my distortions, everything else is going straight in the amp. But I run all my modulation, my flanger, which I use the Tone Works. It's called the Barracuda. How it leaks from Heart designed it, and it's the most amazing flanger I've ever heard. I use that, and, you just kind of run a couple extra guitar cables to your pedal board to the loop, and then whatever cable's running into your amp, you have to run three cables, make a little snake, mm-hmm. and then it allows you to have, really fantastic delay and reverb. It makes a very big difference in the way they sound. It makes them sound more transparent.
Mm-hmm.
And if you run a delay and distortion and all that in the same pedal, then it just washes out. It doesn't sound great. So if you have a loop, it's important to use it.
Yeah, well, it's so funny because when I hear your sound, it's not, like some guys can have a very overprocessed sound. Your sound is so natural, and you can hear the wood of the guitar, and that's what I really like. At the same time, there are times where you play with a lot of gain, but you can still hear the wood. That is always fascinating to me, and I was watching you play. And you play that white Strat with the flag pickguard, with the American flag pickguard, and I'm saying to myself,
yeah,
how in the hell is he getting such a fat sound out of those single coils? It sounds like a humbucker. What in the world, man?
Well, that white Strat, I'll fill you in on it, that white Strat with the American flag that John Cruz built, we ended up pulling out the bridge pickup and we put in a mini humbucker, a Seymour Duncan JB.
Okay.
So that, if you heard me on the neck pickup, you're hearing just a regular single coil. But if I switch to the other pickup, it does get, pretty crunchy. Not quite a full humbucker sound, but, it is getting a little more chunk, and then it eliminates all that 60 cycle hum.
Yeah, for sure. It's such a great sounding guitar. That guitar, and it's funny too, because Strats are an anomaly to me. I have four of them, and neither one sounds anywhere near the same or feels anywhere near the same as the other. And that white Strat of yours is just, it's one of the real good ones. You know what I mean?
Yes, it is. Thank you, man. Yeah, that one has a very special thing about it. I'm not really sure what it is. It's that thing you talked about just now. I have so many guitars and they all have sort of a special thing, or some you just go, this one ain't doing it for me. And it's like a woman, until you hold her in your hands and you caress her, but you really don't know,
mm-hmm. And I find that fascinating because I don't find that whole bunch with Telecasters. I don't find that a whole bunch with even with Les Pauls, but I do find it with Strats. Strats are a unique beast.
Yes, absolutely. Well, that's what makes them special, and that's why we have to have so many of them.
For episode 74, I got the honor to interview Mr. Sonny Landreth. You have a unique technique in that many times you play notes behind the slide. So you're forming chords behind the slide. And where did that get born from?
Had already been playing for quite a number of years and into chordal tuning, so I was tuned to E, and I was playing in a blues band and getting a little frustrated when we played in minor key. I would change positions and make it work, but I just felt like there was another way to do it, and actually would retune the guitar to E minor, for example.
Mm-hmm.
It just seemed to me there would be another way of doing that. I'm trying to think of how I could pull that off, and I had the slide at the 12th fret, and I could see the note behind the third string. I was tuned to E, so I had a G sharp with the slide, and I could see the note back there, and I just thought, well, what happens if I just pressed, if I could just get that note, and I fretted it with the index finger of my left hand while holding the slide, and I strummed all six strings and got a big E minor chord. And I was like, whoa, what just happened here, And so I figured, well, if that one was there, obviously there were others, and started to dig into it. That's what got that whole thing started. But what basically happens is when you fret behind a slide, you have to remember that the slide notes are floating above the fretboard, so they're not touching the neck, right?
Right.
Not touching the fretboard, I should say. And so that gives you enough room to reach back with your left hand, and whichever string or strings you press, you're fretting those, and that string goes underneath the slide.
Mm-hmm.
So you're hearing a combination of fretted notes looking at it, it's kind of like a capo in reverse. It's kind of what's happening.
Right.
But you're hearing a combination of both the fretted notes and the slide notes, and you, create a lot of different colors and sound effects, oscillations, and a lot of things you can do with the combination of those two things together.
Well, you know, it takes a hell of a lot of dexterity, and most folks can't do that. I'm just saying.
Well, I think it was surprising. You know, it's a different beast, no doubt. I mean, but slide guitar per se is. I mean, I had already been playing, I don't know, maybe 3 years, I guess, before I started tackling slide, and it was a completely different mindset. I think what helps, and I'll tell people this too, is if you can, to go ahead and get another guitar set up for it, because I use, what I use for gauge strings are a lot heavier than you typically use your bending strings playing blues or rock or anything else for that matter. And so there's a pull on the neck, and you put some relief in the neck, and you get a little more action and height that way.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how you get the sustain and just enough height off from the string so that you can use the slide and get that sustain.
Right. So your action is fairly high then.
Well, it's high compared to if I were playing, like, you know, did for so long, but not do it much anymore. But I'd use much lighter strings. It'd be really close to action. So it's much different than that. And by doing that, you get used to having like one guitar. Was the point I was trying to follow there, but if you have one guitar dedicated, it's easier to get into that mindset and easier to get in that frame of reference of mine. And that helped me way back when to start making a little more headway with it.
That totally makes sense. Yeah, this way you can just dedicate that instrument to doing that job.
Yeah, you know, I mean, there are no set rules. I mean, it's not like you have to do that. You know, Derek Trucks, fantastic. He's the greatest, and he's 10 to E, and he's a little lighter gauge, just slightly than mine. But and he's 10 to E, and he plays any key, and he's fretting and sliding, and without the slide, you know.
Right.
And so, you know, it's. But I think that for most people, it would help to at least have another guitar set up.
Mm-hmm.
And just kind of helps you get a little farther along.
Mm-hmm.
In particular, with the height and the action, for sure.
Yeah. Have you ever done any standard tuning slide, or is it pretty much mostly?
Oh yeah, sure. Yeah, that's a really cool sound. There's a lot you can do with that. You're limited in one way, and I would say this just in general about tunings and approach and methodology. You know, something will be limited in one way, but then it'll open doors in another way. And so you concentrate on where the strengths, you know, where the strengths may lay or lie with any particular tuning. And standard has its own. Another thing I used to do when I'd go sit in with people and I only want to have one guitar, I had a slightly heavier gauge than the flat, you know, where I used to flat pick.
Mm-hmm.
And I would tune the top string, the E string, down the whole step. And that way, I had a partial G tuning and a top four strings, but I could still fret like I would in standard tuning for the other five strings and have a point of reference. And that was a pretty cool way. You can get some different colors like that too that I like.
Episode 61 gave us an incredible blues man from Memphis, Tennessee, Mr. John D'Amato. So, what can you offer up as far as practice tips?
The big word is practice. Right? The more you do it, the better you get.
Yeah.
What I find works for me all the time, I'm really cognizant of keeping my hands in shape. doing those 1, 2, 3, 4 simple exercises that just get your muscles moving and warm your hands up before you do anything has been a big help for me. The other thing I think that really helps somebody is what I used to do. I would put on a song and play a solo to it. Back then I turned the radio on, and whatever song came up, I tried to determine what key I was in and if I could play a solo on it. Whatever it was, if it was a Neil Diamond song, if it was a Dionne Warwick song, if it was an AC/DC song, how are you going to approach the song?
Mm-hmm.
And that really helped me a lot in my guitar playing life and doing sessions for people or filling in for somebody and learning how to just do things on the fly.
So essentially just trying to be the chameleon.
Exactly. Because it's going to challenge you from a couple of different standpoints. It's going to challenge your theory, knowledge, your ear, and your creativity.
Cool.
You know, you got to come up with something that fits this song. You got to know what key you're in, because there's nobody there telling you. There's nobody there giving you a chart.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to have the technique to pull it off.
Very good. Excellent. Thanks, John.
Sure.
Folks, you can go to johndiamato.net. Check out the new album. It's called Born Blue. On episode 47 of Guitar Radio Show, we were lucky enough to have the great Greg Martin from the Kentucky Headhunters. What was the impetus for you to pick up the guitar in the first place? What was it?
Well, oddly enough, I did grow up in a household where there was guitars around. I was lucky. I had a cousin from our that moved up to Louisville, where I grew up. And he had a nice old 335.net there at the house. And I had another brother that had like a Strat. So when they were at work, I would go pick their guitars up and play on them and bang on them. And I would have to say, you know, the family thing, then my dad and my uncle played country music. My brothers were into rock. And there was a great record collection at the house. We had the Dentures, Lonnie Mack, Travis Womack. I remember a Roy Clark album, some instrumental Roy Clark album in there. But also then when the Beatles hit, they had Beatles and Rolling Stones albums. And when I saw the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show in 1964, it pushed a button. And I thought, wow, this is very cool. And so I started picking up the guitar and just playing on it. And, you know, take the first song I learned how to play was What I Say by Ray Charles, and then picked up on whatever was popular of the day. Just nothing real serious. I didn't really get serious about guitar until 1968. That's when everything just kind of come together, and I said, well, that's what I want to do. And sometime around that period, I heard, '67, I heard Eric Clapton of Cream and Jimi Hendrix and Jeff Beck with his group. Of course, see, I was hip to the Yardbirds, and because we had Yardbirds singles around the house, I already knew Jeff Beck was a great player, you know. But when I heard Clapton, Sunshine and Love, I think that was another milestone moment, you know. Hearing it on AM radio, just hearing that guitar, you know, very lyrical guitar with great vibrato, and I think that just kind of set me off on my path. That right there did, you know. And a lot of good, great local bands on Louisville. I have to say that there was a guy by the name of Frank Buffy that was in a band called Alicia Field, a trio. I went to see them in '68, and it was almost like a spiritual experience. Called 11th Spoonful in '66, and that was another milestone moment as well. You know, there's just several things that kind of worked together. But when I saw Frank Buckley play in '68 with the Legion Field, 2 weeks later I met Richard, Fred, and Anthony, and we started off on our little adventure. So, like things were meant to be, you know?
Yeah, it sounds like it. It sounds like it was all like almost preordained.
Yeah, it kind of was, man. It's kind of scary. I mean, my dad, got fed up with Louisville in 1956. You know, and I had just seen the Love and Spoonful at the Moore Auditorium, and I thought, and of course, what really stands out in my mind about that was John Sebastian was playing this cool little Gibson guitar, which turned out to be a first of Turnbow's Les Paul, of course. And I was really infatuated with the shape of that guitar. Of course, I loved Valley as well in that band. But in 66, Dad got fed up and he moved us down to Metcalf County. And that, I could have only met Richard and Fred by that happening, because me living in Louisville, that would have never happened. So when I moved to Metcalf County, and right after Christmas of 66, I had nothing to do but listen to radio records, and there was an old Stella acoustic guitar. At that point, my brother and my cousin were still in Louisville. I just banged on that Stella and tried to pick out songs, so that was kind of it. You know, nothing else to do but play guitar.
Nothing wrong with that.
No, not at all. And I always say that guitar saved my life, Jesus saved my soul.
There you go. Episode 38 led us to a great conversation with the one and only J.D. Simo. He is the future of rock guitar, in our estimation. And he had a conversation with us about a very special guitar. Check it out. Let's talk about that beautiful... I mean, you know, it's so funny. You see it on YouTube and you hear it on the records, and it's like it's... For some reason, this particular guitar of yours is so three-dimensional. It jumps off the screen, it jumps out of the speakers, and it just kind of pours itself all over you when you listen to it. It's this beautiful 1962 Gibson ES-335 that you have.
Yeah, Red. She served me very, very well.
Yeah. Now you play slide on there, and your slide style I absolutely love. It's very.
Thank you.
It's got a Dwayne vibe, but you've put your own thing on, your own stamp on it. Do you keep, how high do you keep the action with this guitar?
Usually, I mean, it varies guitar to guitar, but not that high. I mean, it's higher than probably most people. But it's not like Stevie Ray Vaughan high.
Yeah.
You know, it's up off the frets, but that has nothing to do with my preference for my action. Really has nothing to do with the slide playing. It has more to do with I like to be able to get under the string, and also it's kind of a loaded statement, but you know if you can get your action to at least a decent height, it's going to make the guitar sound better. You know, obviously it's more apparent in acoustics than it is in electrics, but it is still relevant to electrics. And, you know, obviously there's other things I could discuss about that, because, you know, you obviously can have, you know, you don't want your, if you have a Gibson with a tailpiece, you don't want your tailpiece in relation to your action. You don't want the break angle to be so sharp that it's choking your notes off.
Mm-hmm.
But you want it sharp enough that you get twang out of the instrument. You know, all those things are... I'm very meticulous about the way I set things up. And, you know, and I'll use my... You know, really it comes down to ears more than anything else.
Yeah.
But it's not... It's not too terribly high. I mean, I can't remember the measurements off the top of my head, but, you know, I just learned when I finally started tackling slide after many years of being scared of it. You know, it was, you know, the goal for me with playing slide was I would love to get to a point where I can literally play it at any given time in any given context as an option.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to me it's like having a pedal on a pedal board. It's like always having that option there and being able to use it if I want. You know, so, you know, playing in standard tuning on whatever way my guitar is set up, you know, that's what kind of dictated that. Mm-hmm. I like playing in other tunings, especially on acoustic, because I'm a huge, I don't really do acoustic stuff. I know we're doing an acoustic show in October sometime. Me and my good friend Jack Pearson, who's in the Allman Brothers, who's a monstrously talented guitarist, probably my favorite guitarist on the planet. But he's amazing. But I love playing acoustic music, and I love playing acoustic guitar. It just hasn't found its way into what Simo does really yet. But in that context, I like tunings, but generally standard, you know.
Yeah. And you have a pretty heavy touch when you
play. Not with slide. I've worked really hard to. I developed a lot of bad habits when I was playing with Don Kelly. I developed a lot of good habits too for the period of time I was playing with Don. But one of the bad habits I developed was being too heavy-handed with my right hand. And so that's something over the last few years, since I haven't been with him, that I've been able to kind of rectify a certain amount. But with slide guitar, you have to have a lighter touch.
Yeah, got to lay
down. Sometimes the energy gets the better of me, and I might play harder than I would like to.
Uh-huh.
But generally, I try and be pretty light, even if it doesn't seem like it. Because again, if you play too hard, you're going to get a real sharp attack, and you're not going to get any kind of bloom out of the note. Mm-hmm. It's kind of, guitar is a lot like a drum in that, if you hit a drum really, really hard, you're going to get a loud attack, and then it's going to die away because you're choking off, the sound of it,
Right.
Whereas if you play at kind of a medium velocity, you'll get all the tone, but then you'll also get a beautiful bloom and sustain out of the note, And so it's guitar and drums are very similar in that way. And in that regard, it's funny because, I'm pretty obsessed with drums, and I've worked with a lot of world-class, wonderful drummers. And, the ones that I had, that I got more enjoyment out of working with were the ones that were not bashers, They were ones that actually got, beautiful, beautiful tones out of their drums, Mm-hmm. And there's a couple I'm thinking of in my mind. I won't say them, but there's a couple that are very, very famous that I've worked with that, are heavy, heavy hitters. And it's like, what good is a $5,000-$10,000 drum kit when you're beating the living daylights out of it and all the tone is, going out of the drum because
right.
you're beating it different.
Right.
So.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's much like guitar. There has to be that finesse that has to be in there.
Yeah, I mean, you can play with aggression, with authority, but there is a certain medium ground, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Especially with slide guitar, it's a very different thing because you can't really be heavy-handed with either hand and play slide in tune and having the note ring and stay there for a while.
Mm-hmm. Episode 48, we had Chris Duarte on, and we ran through his rig and his amazing exotic Strat guitar. Check it out. So let's talk about your gear. You had that 1963 Strat that you got when you came to Austin in 79. But folks, if you go to page 153 of the latest issue of Guitar Player, there's a full page ad with Chris playing one of your exotic Strats.
Right.
Tell us what's going on guitar wise for you nowadays.
Okay, the way the exotic endorsement came about is that first Strat I got in 79 or 80. Actually, I acquired it in 1980, February of 80. L14261, still remember the serum. That one was actually ripped off from me in New York City back in 93, when we are already kind of in negotiations and creating a relationship with Zomba.
Wow.
And so, I mean, that guitar, that L14261, was like the best sounding Strat I'd ever heard. It sounded great. I could still tell. You can bring up an old bootleg tape, and I'll know that it's that Strat.
Mm-hmm.
I know the tone. So then I got another Strat, another 63 Strat. Supposedly, Eric Clapton. This is Eric Clapton's guitar. The legend even grows more. Supposedly, it's the one he wrote Layla on. I don't believe any of this until I asked Sir Eric himself. But we actually were contacted by the daughter of the guy that sold it to us. It's, he sold it to my fan club president in Colorado, and he had to meet him in a parking lot of a music store, and he was trying to get rid of these guitars because he had gotten cancer, and he was a stockbroker or a money financier, financial advisor to, like, George Harrison, Eric Clapton, some other people, and they had given him these guitars, and so he was selling them. And when he heard that I was looking for a 63, my 63 was stolen, he was like, I'm going to sell it to a player. I'm not going to sell it to the Hard Rock or any of these collectors. Mm-hmm. It's going to be played. This guitar deserves to be played. And so that's what he did. He met him in a place, and it was for a reasonable price. It was only a couple thousand. It was like $2,100. For me, that was a jump from buying my first guitar to $500. Now I'm paying $2,000. And this was in... This has got to be probably in early 90, around 93 or something like that. Somewhere around there. It was before we did Texas Sugar, because the guitar that I currently have now, which is serial number 71699, is the one that is on the picture of Texas Sugar.
Okay.
So that guitar is now, I've played it like for, you know, I'm an extremely physical player. We play long shows, you know. It's not uncommon to play a three-hour show in totality. You know, two sets, equaling 3 hours, and close to 3.5, 4 hours sometimes. But, you know, the frets wear down, and I have the biggest frets you can get, the big old jumbos.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you get a fret job, I'd have to get a fret job because of my extremely busy schedule, well over 100 gigs a year for years and years and years. You have to get a fret job every other year. You know, I have to replace the frets because I wear them down. And so when you do that, of course, you blame the guitar neck. And you get that, you get all the pits and stuff out of the rosewood, and you reseed it. Well, after years and years of that, what's left now of that rosewood on that neck is just a thin veneer, very thin. And I did not want to take that. I did not want to replace it, put a new slab on it. You know, so I retired it. So when I was retiring it, the technology had come along where Fender could exactly replicate the guitar, exactly. And I thought, wouldn't that be cool to have this guitar replicated? So I went to Fender, and I said, I need you guys to replicate this. I'm not looking for a special deal. And I've got a relationship with Fender. I've had one for a long time. Still do, as a matter of fact. But we went to one of the cubicles. We discussed what they do, and he quoted me a price, and I was like, you know, that's the price of the guy walking in off the street. I said, this is me. And, I mean, what I still wanted to pay was still a lot of money, but I was still willing to give him. They said, oh, yes, talk to somebody in the office. I did know somebody in the office. You know, I'm not going to mention any names, but I was promised that it would be taken care of. And, of course, you have to send it out to California. And so they can do that laser spectrometer or whatever it is to cover it. Well, we waited for a year, and nothing had been done. I couldn't play this guitar anymore. So Exotic stepped in, and they said, we'll make you a guitar. I said, well, you have to copy the neck size exactly, because I do not want my left hand having to reacquaint itself with the new neck. I want to hit the ground running. So that's what they did. They got the measures and short. And even though I'm not the biggest fan of those angular head stocks and stuff, and the body, of course, a little bit different from a Strat for litigious reasons, but Exotic takes very good care of me, and the pickups in it are Exotic pickups. And they actually, that gold guitar is my number one guitar, and I do play it out on the road. And my backup is the first one they gave me, an Ice Blue guitar. You know, I think it's called the XJS-1. I'm so terrible with model numbers. That's how the Exotic guitar came, and I'm proud to say that I'm an Exotic endorser because they take really good care of me, and they stand behind me.
Well, that gold flake one that you have is badass, man. That thing is cool.
Man, it's, and you know, the funny thing is, I love the old late 60s Fenders for the headstocks for the same color.
Yeah.
So that was one of my requirements, okay? You want to make guitars to me, you have to make the headstock the same color as the guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, and it's, I'd always wanted to play, I love the old metal gold sparkle straps, and I'd always wanted one.
Right.
So when they said, what color do you want now? I said, make it gold sparkle.
Yeah,
it's good. You know, it's got a bit of an awe factor when you bring it out. And
yeah.
It's not because of Dick Dale, because I love Dick Dale, too. But that's not the reason I got a gold sparkle. They did a really fine job. And that was the luthier that made it at the time was, I think it's Hiro Imura. I think that was his name. And Hiro-san, he's gone back to me. He's not with them anymore. But they still have a very fine luthier that takes care of me. But he did the finish, and it's just such a great job. But when they presented it to me, they forgot to do the headstock. I sent it back. I said, got to do the headstock. Sorry.
Well, they got it right. It looks damn cool.
Yeah, it's a good guitar. It's a real good guitar. So.
Episode 45 gave us our first Mondo episode. It was a 2-hour joint of tons and tons of stuff, but it featured guitarist Louis Hanoi from the band Lightbulb Vaporizer of Vancouver. And killer band, cool freak out jams. And here he talks to us about playing these tunes live. Check it out. What's it like playing this stuff live?
We never play anything the same twice. We don't even play these songs.
Uh-huh. So you guys get up there and...
Yeah, we're an entire... The entire band is improv. So these were only those 2 days captured. And they'll never be played again.
Wow.
Never.
That's pretty...
Matter of fact, yeah, because we want to do a double drum thing live. We just experiment live. People who come to see our shows now are, you know, they want to be a part of the live thing that's going to happen right there, whatever it is, because they know that they're never going to, the majority of them are never going to hear this again, because it's whatever we felt at that particular moment.
So do you try to make a habit of recording every show?
Yes, we do. Although they're, you know, they're like your typical kind of, sound like you're in a windstorm kind of recordings. They're just not of the quality that you have.
Right.
That you're listening to. They're just your, but we do record every jam.
Uh-huh.
We record everything. For what reason? I really don't know. Someday maybe we'll do something with it, but.
Well, I mean, you never know. I mean, you might stumble across the lost chord. Who knows?
Yeah, you know what? I've been looking for that chord for a long time. That would at least mean I know three.
Yeah.
I'm okay with two chords, but it's when the third one gets in there.
Tell me about it.
Then I start solo right away because I can't do that third chord.
Yeah. So, you know, like I said earlier...
I've been fortunate with the guys around me. I mean, the guys around me are absolutely amazing. Like, the whole band started with me and the drummer. It was just one of those things. It was we were in a bad headspace, and we just kind of needed to make some noise. We didn't need to make music, really. It wasn't so much, hey, let's write a song or, you know, try to write a great riff. Fuck that. Just plug in. I knew we could play, and we just started to play, and it really clicked between us two, and then we just kind of run with it from there on in.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really, really, like, 30, 35 minutes of music therapy, realistically. And I kind of looked at him at the end of it, and I said, well, you know, that was pretty amazing, and that's it. And just kind of grew from there. People heard it. We played it as a two-piece at the beginning. People dug it, and all of a sudden people wanted to join. It's like, I need to be in this band. It's like, what do you play again? It doesn't matter. I need to be in this band. Okay, welcome aboard.
Episode 62 gave us the incomparable Scott Gaylor. He and I had a chance to talk a little bit about the vintage market, which he knows a little something about. So we have Scott Gaylor with us. His new record is called Technicolor Monochrome. You can reach out to him at scottgaylor.com. How are you, Scott?
I'm doing great, man. How are you doing?
All right. So listen, we're here talking about the state of the vintage guitar market. You and I have had many conversations via Facebook, me just throwing up a picture of something that I might be interested in buying, like particularly that 25th anniversary Strat that I was looking at. And you had some interesting things to say about it. What's your opinion in regards to the state of the vintage guitar market?
Well, give you a little background. I did work at Guitar Center for a minute in between touring and doing different stuff over the years, and I was part of doing vintage stuff with them here and there. I wasn't part of the vintage team, but I passed all the vintage certification stuff, and that market has really changed from even 2005 to now. It has dropped tremendously, but I think it's making it an upswing.
That's what I keep hearing, yeah.
I think it's a good time to buy, honestly, if you have the money and you can find some good pieces, because everything's going to jump up. But especially if you look at like the 59s and some of the older, even Broadcasters or Esquires, you can pick them up a lot cheaper than you could, you know, even 5 or 6 years ago. Mm-hmm. So investment-wise, it's making the swing up, but it's still not anywhere at its peak where, you know, God, at one point, what was it, 93, 94, you could pick up a Burst for $5,000 to $8,000. And now, yeah, you know, you're not even playing in the ballpark. You can barely get a, you know, 70s custom that's clean for $5,000. So it's definitely in a weird spot. And it's, you know how this goes. It's trendy too. You get into 1 week it's Tellys, next week it's, you know, it's 59s, next week it's Strats. And who would have thought a 70 Strat that anybody would want, not only want, but want to pay $5,000 to $7,000 for?
No, I agree with you. I agree. It's really interesting, the changes of it all. But I do see a lot of guitars leaving the country, a lot of vintage instruments leaving the country.
Yeah, that breaks my heart a little bit. Thank God for Joe Bonamassa and his collection, at least that's in the States.
Yeah, he's definitely holding on to stuff, that's for sure. Like a warehouse.
He's got great stuff on top of it. It's not just stuff. He's got the legit real deal stuff, man. He's one of those guys I look at his stuff all the time and I'm just like, damn, we'd like to just sit at that house for a day.
Yeah, just let us hang out in the warehouse. For sure.
Yeah, I won't break anything, I promise. If I break it, I can fix it.
Like after. Yeah. So it should be interesting. It should be interesting this year to see what the all the vintage shows as we swing through the year, watching what the prices are going to do and the quality of what's left. Because I find it fascinating that now, because a lot of the 50s and early 60s and all the way through the late 60s stuff is getting to a place where most folks can't get at it. And, you know, the 70s stuff is starting to become popular.
Yeah, I mean, I've got a 74 Les Paul Standard, and it was a guitar that's, you know, it's a pancake body and all that. I had a knee bone nut cut for it, and I had jumbo frets put into it because I just didn't really think it was going to have any value. I wanted a guitar I could play, and it was already beat to hell. But now, as you flip back, you know, it's a guitar that's worth a little bit of money, which wouldn't, again, even in the early 80s, you will scoff at that guitar because of the pancake body. But like you said, now that guys can't get the 50s and 60s guitars, or even very early 70s, some of these things have become worth value, surprisingly enough.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing. And I only see it going up. I can't imagine it really coming down all that much.
No, it's making the same bounce the housing market is, I think. Yeah. I think really one of the biggest gains right now are pedals. Vintage pedals have really jumped up.
Yeah.
Because that's kind of my second hobby. And I'm actually having a pedal built for me by this guy, Kiefer Thorson, who fixes and tweaks every little thing I ever come up with. But I've been trying to find an old Boss's, an FA1. Remember that preamp they had?
Yeah.
And I'm not paying $400 or $500 for one of those, especially all the ones I see online are beat to death. So we're going to try to build one. Actually, I shouldn't say we. He's going to try to build one for me. And because I don't want to pay that kind of money for one and not find the one. You know what I mean? It's such a weird crapshoot. And even like the old Boss pedals have jumped up, or even original Keeley stuff. It's pretty crazy. I mean, I think the pedal market is really, the vintage pedal market, I should say.
Yeah.
Probably bouncing back way quicker than the vintage guitar market.
Yeah. Well, what I see, what like Tube Screamers alone just blows my mind.
Yeah, I have one, and I mean, I paid $15 for that used.
Yeah.
In, I don't know, 85 or something. And I mean, mine's beat to hell, and it's still, guys see it and they freak out because it's a real one, and you know, it's all original. I've got an all original my Randy Rose box, an MXR Distortion Plus, Scrib logo, the whole bit. Yeah. The only reason I got that, just because I was a Randy Rose freak and that was what he used, and I've used it maybe 3 times and it just sits there and stares at me, but I had to
Well, Scott, thanks for weighing in on the vintage market. I appreciate it.
No problem. Anytime.
Yeah, man. Hey, folks, check out scottgaylor.com. You can check out his new album, Technicolor Monochrome. Talking about vintage gear, we had a great conversation with Mr. Tom Guerra on episode 58 of Guitar Radio Show. Check it out. All right, we have Tom Guerra from Vintage Guitar Magazine. Hey, Tom.
Hey, how are you, Mark?
Good. So we're talking about the state of the vintage guitar market, not only in America, but worldwide. I mean, I go to vintage shows all the time. One of my favorites is the Dallas Guitar Festival. In your opinion, what do you think the state of the vintage guitar market is like now?
I think in 2015, it's a lot healthier than it was in 2008. I think at that point in time, when the whole economy tanked, people were very, very concerned. Up to that point, I was seeing, you know, crazy prices for stuff. And then after that, there was a very, very slow recovery. But I do think for those A-grade instruments, and I primarily am interested in electric guitars from sort of the golden age, you are seeing those sort of classic instruments get up there in price once again.
Now, so you think those prices are going to go up?
I do think that they'll continue to go up. I think that they only made so few of these instruments, and the folks that are now the ones with the disposable income that are able to buy the instruments that their heroes once played. So I do see, you know, things going up again and things looking really good for the guitar market.
That's cool. So let me ask you this. I mean, every time that I'm at a show, I always see when the show starts, there's these empty booths. And as the day or the weekend progresses, those empty booths start to get filled with guitar cases. And sooner or later, I see a bunch of Asian men taking those cases and putting them onto trucks.
Yeah, I've seen that phenomenon myself at the New York guitar shows during the 90s. So I saw one Asian gentleman in a suit walking around and pointing at guitars, and his assistant behind him would go up to the booth and buy those guitars that he pointed out. So I do think stuff is still going overseas.
Yeah, I think it's a huge market there.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, what does that mean for the American buyer? Do you think that the prices will go even higher?
in regards to that situation, that it's leaving America and now it's going there and the prices are going to go up higher to get it back?
I don't really know. I think we're in a global economy right now.
For sure.
And I think if you're selling something, if it's priced right, no matter who wants to buy it, they're going to buy it, no matter where they are.
Yeah.
Provided, you know, they don't use a lousy carrier who destroys the guitar. But I digress. But so I think even, you know, even if this was the other way around and some person in China was selling or Japan was selling a 1959 Les Paul, and somebody here wanted that particular Burst, you know, they would buy it. So I see the world as being more open than it was 25 years ago.
Right.
And I mean, let's face it, you can do a Google search on whoever's selling a particular instrument, identify, you know, that instrument and track that person down no matter where they are in the world and, you know, do your homework and take precaution, but you could buy that instrument if you have the means.
Right. For sure. So what do you think, I know this is probably an obvious question, but what are the two guitars to look for?
The two, I'd say, you know, three guitars to look for, always have been. Number one, the most collectible vintage guitar is a 58 through 1960 Sunburst Les Paul called the Burst. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of books out there on Bursts, Burst Believers. And Burst Believers 2 are great books on that.
Great
by
books. Great.
My friend Vic DeCroix.
Yeah.
So that would be number one. And then I would say number two and three would be really depending on your preference, under, you know, 50s Strats and Tellys, excuse me, and then, you know, then pre-CVS stuff up to, you know, mid-65, you know, January 65 was the cutover to CVS. They were still using a lot of good parts. So 64 and earlier Strats and Tellys. And then the next chunk, I think, are those 65 to, you know, 70, 71 Strats. And then from there, you know, there's a whole acoustic market that people are huge into. I couldn't really tell you, you know, from that perspective, besides the early Martin stuff, what is really hot. But those, from an electric perspective, those are the big three.
Yeah. What's your take on? I mean, like you said, you're not really in on the acoustic market all that much. But what are you thinking about the Gibson Banners?
Oh, I'm not really familiar with them.
Those are the ones that were made in Kalamazoo during the war, during World War II. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't really know, you know, what they're selling for. I mean, I'm familiar with the instrument, but I can't really tell you if they're hot or not either. Yeah. I probably should pay more attention to the acoustic guitar market, but I've always been an electric player, so that's sort of where my loyalties lie.
Yeah, same here. I mean, it's just a guitar that's fascinating me. I had read the book Kalamazoo Gals. And I found it fascinating. So what do you think of which are the ones to avoid?
Oh, gee, I don't want to be tell people that, but I'm not going to single out a particular instrument, but I would say, you know, just because it's old doesn't mean it's vintage, or just because it's old doesn't mean it's good.
Right.
You know, sort of the common thought behind that is some folks say, well, they've played a lot of crappy, you know, pre-CBS Fenders. Well, I played a lot of them. I haven't really played many crappy ones. There's something about each one that I sort of like. And the fact that they were a little bit more handmade makes them a little bit more variable from instrument to instrument. But in terms of what to avoid, I would just say, you know, avoid the flu.
Good job. Thanks, Tom. Hey, folks, you can you can go to tomgarrett.com. You can also read Tom's work in Vintage Guitar Magazine. Tom has an album out called All of the Above. You can get that on iTunes and Amazon and all those great places. Tom, thanks for checking in with us.
All right. Thank you, Mark.
All right.
Episode 71, found us talking to the virtuoso, Scott Henderson.
You like to bring the songs out on the road for a while, let them breathe.
Yeah. Because then, you know, we all invent stuff on these songs every night we play. And every night there's sort of like a growth or like a creative process that happens every night where we add our little ideas to the tunes and make them better, you know. So after you've played the music a little while on the road, it's always better when you go in and record.
Yeah. One time I was interviewing Pat Metheny, and I asked him about titles for his songs, and he said that he would prefer that he wished he didn't have to title his songs at all, because he feels that many times the title influences what people are going to think about the song.
Uh-huh.
What do you think about titles?
And actually, I think it's kind of fun to think of names for the tune.
Yeah.
It's fun for me. I don't really care about, you know, like what it makes people think of, because they'll interpret the music as they feel. But it's important to me to what the song sounds like to me.
Mm-hmm.
So, and sometimes I don't, you know, always like the choices I make later, but I think on this album, the choices fit pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
So, who knows, maybe in a month I'll feel differently.
Episode 91 gave us a chance to talk to Eric Gales and working with producer Rafael Sadiq.
And that's why, I mean, and with this record, with the tunes that you wrote and your playing and his production, it was a perfect marriage of all this information.
You know, it's amazing how it all came together, but that's exactly the fusion together that I was looking for.
Yeah.
And you know, it just came together, man. You know, it, like I said, I'm very fond of all of the stuff that I put out, but it's something about this project that was like really amazing to me. Like really, you know, just how it all unfolded and came together, and the highlights and the real treats for me, and just, you know, things that how everything came together was good. It was absolutely good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think this is probably one of your strongest vocal performance too over the years.
I think so as well.
Yeah.
It's you know, I don't want to say that I went in another direction, but I stayed true to my core and where I'm from, but just did it with a modern approach to it, and mm-hmm. just looked like to me a little more diverse than last record, you know?
Yeah, you absolutely. I couldn't agree more. Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's you, and you can tell it's you. It's not, you know, there's no guessing, but at the same time, it's fresh.
I agree.
Yeah. I was recently reading an article about you in a magazine, and you said something that really struck a chord with me, and you said that you give me a pig nose amp and a Fender Squire, and I'm going to make some music.
Right.
I love that.
Absolutely.
Because I totally absolutely agree with that.
Absolutely. It could be a pig nose and a Sears Silver Tone. it really doesn't matter what it is, it's what you can do with it. You know what I mean?
That's right. Absolutely. So let's.
I mean, at the end of the day, you know, it is a good addition to the recipe to have a good tone, you know, both guitar and amp wise. It's like, you know, the perfect foundation, but mm-hmm. at the end of the day, it's what you do with what you have. You know, you don't have to have all the extremities of all the different kinds of sound effects and all that, multiple different amps or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's, when it boils down, you just go bare bones, straight guitar, chord, and amp. You
That's
know what
right.
I mean? Just, let's see what you can do with it then.
Yeah.
Last few years, we've been lucky enough to have a ton of great gear makers on the show, known and unknown. And episode 36 gave us Mr. Tim Marcus from Milkman Amps.
These are some really amazing sounding amps. Pure, I guess for lack of a better term, pure Americana in a box.
Yeah, that's it.
You know, I'm really digging it. And I would say you're probably at the, you're really entrenched in the boutique aspect of things. Would you consider yourself a boutique amp maker?
Yes, I guess so. I mean, I guess that's kind of the word.
This is the word of the moment anyway.
It is. I mean, you know, that's kind of like when it's funny because, you know, when things used to be manufactured back in the, you know, 50s and 60s, I mean, that's just how they did it. It wasn't boutique then.
Exactly.
It was just everything was built by hand.
Right. It was just built then, really good.
Yeah, it was built well, and that's why you see a lot of those old amps, you know, and people still have and they still work. But, right. You know, so I would say that I just kind of built it in that. The reason I say it's like, you know, vintage electronics or whatever, it's kind of constructed in that vintage style.
Right.
Where everything is kind of handmade and,
right.
You know, most of the parts are made in the U.S. as much as I can find. I mean, it's obviously not possible to go 100%, but, you know, you can get pretty close.
Yeah. That's actually an interesting thing, just the fact that we touched on that just now, that years ago it used to be a whole bunch of people making a really good piece of equipment. Now you've got to have one or two people, or maybe five or six people, if you're lucky, making that same quality. How do we get so turned around?
Well, what happened was, this is what I think happened, is that, you know, somewhere along the line, someone decided that a guitar amplifier needs to be $500.
Yeah.
And if you're going to deliver a product at that price and still, you know, keep the lights on, you can't build it the way that what most of the boutique guys are building. You know, there's just no way, you know.
In today's market, yeah.
And the other thing is that, you know, a lot of people say, oh, well, the boutique amps are so expensive. But actually, if you do the dollar adjustment and look at what they would have cost in the 1960s, they're actually less expensive,
mm-hmm.
you know, after, mm-hmm. you know, if you factor in inflation. So you could, it could still work that way, but, you know, they're the ones that are being sold to the, you know, the masses are just, you know, you just can't really compete.
Yeah.
I guess.
Yeah.
It's all about the economy of scale, I guess.
Yeah, I would agree. And, you know, so that begs the question that I have for you, which is, why did you decide to do this? Was this because you couldn't get what you were looking for?
That's exactly it. I was, maybe about 10 years ago, I started playing the steel guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And I had an old twin reverb, 135-watt amp, and it was just like someone was driving an ice pick into my forehead when I would hit anything on the G-sharp string, which is like the highest string on the steel guitar. It just was not smooth sounding. It was too glassy, I guess would be the word that
right.
for that. And so I just started going in and modifying it, and I was never really happy. So I was like, you know what? I just got to start from scratch and figure out a circuit that, you know, will work for this instrument that I like. And, you know, so that's what I kind of did. I just kind of dug in and started with that model.
Right. So now that's interesting because you have, you know, you're making guitar amps and you're also making pedal steel amps. So
yes.
here's a question from the uninitiated and the person who doesn't know, and that's me. What is the difference between a pedal steel amp and a regular guitar amp?
The main difference, as far as this is just my personal philosophy, I mean, a lot of guys use low power amps for steel, including myself sometimes, you know, there's no rules. But the main thing is that a steel guitar is like, it has this huge bandwidth, you know, you got, especially if you're playing with the one, sometimes you see the guys with the double neck,
mm-hmm.
and that the low string on that double neck goes down to the same as like an open A string on a bass, right? So you're going from there all the way up to, like, you know, some of the guys are doing pinch harmonic stuff really high, like, you know, higher than a guitar will go, and just in the same instrument. And you could be doing that at, you know, just in the course of like one solo.
Mm-hmm.
A steel player can take it all over the place, and there's complex harmonics. Mm-hmm. Things are bending all over the place. It's like someone, like, you know, put a you know, drop of acid into a Telecaster or something, and you're just like, well, all the notes are bending all over the place. That's kind of what the steel guitar is like. And, you know, the only way that you're really going to get capture all that is just with a ton of power.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing that steel guitar players like is when, you know, they don't really want the distortion sound of the amplifier. And so you want to just, you want just a tiny little bit, but you don't want it to be like breaking up. Like, you know, if you're playing a Telecaster out of a Princeton or a Deluxe, like you can really dig in and it sounds great. But with steel, it really thins out the instrument. So it's for me, I like to think that you want to have more of like a hi-fi kind of sound.
Oh, interesting.
From the pedal.
Okay.
Killer Bee Guitars.
Episode 40 gave us Memphis guitar maker Kevin Butts from Killer Bee Guitars. Check it out. So, so give us an update on Killer Bee Guitars. What's going on over there?
Man, things are going really well. I'm actually just about running out of inventory here. My new Killer Bee Deluxe guitars, making a single cut and a double cut version. They they're moving okay. They're moving pretty good, and I was going to be at NAMM this year, but I decided to take a step back, focus on some things, and actually have a new patent design. I'm waiting on my patent number before I release it for a new type of thing on a guitar, and kind of don't really want to talk about it until I get the patent number, but mm-hmm. it will definitely be featured on your show.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So hopefully that'll be coming soon, but I will be at NAMM, floating around, hanging out with Dylan Pickups, actually probably hanging with the guys from Nikita Guitars. I've been talking to them and kind of working on some ideas with them and stuff, and some other vendors I work with, so I'll be hanging around there, and then look for me October in Guitarlington, which we're excited about.
Yeah, I'll be there.
The Four Amigos show, uh-huh. talked to the owner, the guy that runs it, just the other day, and going to get my booth lined up, and hopefully have some really cool guitars there.
Very cool. Very cool. Folks, go to killerbeeguitars.com. And check them out. You can also check out the full-length episode and interview with Kevin and me on Guitar Radio Show. Just go to guitarradioshow.com and type in Killer Bee Guitars, and you'll find plenty of stuff, including videos. Do you ever get a tone or a sound in your head that you've played from a piece of gear and you just can't get it out of your head that haunts you? Well, that's what it was when I got to play the Magnetone amps, the Master Series, at the Dallas Guitar Show. And we were lucky enough to sit down and, actually stand up, with Ted Kornblum from Magnetone Amps on episode 31 of Guitar Radio Show. Check it out.
You just touched on something, no pun intended, but you just touched on something about the touch sensitivity of the amp.
Yeah.
Yesterday, I got to play one of the Master Series, the black ones, and I was really in awe of, obviously, the tone, the bell-like qualities that you're able to get out of it. But, yes, the fact that when I, depending on my touch and depending on how I attack the instrument, would determine the ferocity, the magnificent tone that I would get out of the amp. And that's something that I don't really get a lot with some of the other tube amplifiers that are out there now.
I think that's a very viable point. You know, it's good players know how to turn the volume down on their guitar and clean up that way.
I mean, it's one of those, I'm sorry to interrupt, but that's one of those amps that I think it's like, really, this is about my guitar, my cable, and then to the amp. And then everything else be damned, because I can make it work with what I've got here.
That actually is what Billy Gibbons has said. You're right. And actually, Larry Craig from the Brown, I think that's a real, you touched on it. I think that it's the dynamic range, the touch sensitivity, the ability to know how to use the amplifier and the guitar together. And again, it's they're all tube amps, so there's a bit of black magic that goes into making circuits that are that way. I think we've listened a lot to the market and tested. You know, I could have brought the company to market about a year and a half, maybe even earlier. we took about 4 years of engineering and development to bring it to market. And I could have brought it earlier, but I really wanted to cover enough different types of people's taste to find out what we needed to do, because there's something I guess people call musician syndrome, which is when the musician says they know how it's supposed to sound and therefore they make the product sound the way they like it.
Right.
But in reality, we want to make them the way the consumer or customer likes them. So a lot of input.
Yeah.
Episode 88, I got one of my wishes to come true. I got to interview Red Volkert. Not only did I get to interview him, but I got to interview him at the bar at the Continental Club in Austin, Texas.
Was there any one particular country player that you felt was definitive in your influence?
I don't know if I could say there was one. I mean, there were several guys. You know, Don Rich from Buck Owens' band, Merle Haggard's band, Ed Roy Nichols. Jimmy Bryant was an amazing instrumental player, but, you know, I still can't figure his stuff out.
Yeah,
so.
But a lot like Les Paul in that way.
Yeah, that kind of. So the, all those guys to me were amazing in their own thing. I mean, I'm sure I didn't know or recognize that, oh, this guy's an instrumentalist and this one knows how to play in a band better or not. Or I didn't know any of that or really give a shit one way or another at the time. So all of those guys, to me, played great, so I wanted to steal all their stuff and try and copy it and emulate those sounds. And if I could put them in with a band I was playing with, great. If I couldn't, well, I'd keep trying.
Well, here's something. I mean, you know, it's so funny. As a kid growing up, I would steal my dad's Jimmy Bryant records, and I would hear them, and many times I didn't know that there was a Speedy West.
Right. You thought it was all
Jimmy. I thought it was all Jimmy. Sure. And I'd be like, how in the world is that happening? But it's funny because whenever I come to see you play, and I see you play quite a bit, you do that. You're able to bounce back and forth between those two.
Well, it's, there again, it's just, it's all emulating and stealing their stuff, you know. Yeah. So it's kind of like, if you don't know when you're a kid and you don't know that's not that guy, you find there's a will, there's a way,
right.
And you MacGyver yourself a little way to to figure out how to get that sound.
Sure,
so,
yeah.
But yeah, I've always been a steel guitar fan as well.
Yeah.
So always trying to copy that sort of sound and get those flavors in my playing. So a bunch of little things I've, you know, either stole from other steel players or the records or from playing with other guys and go, ooh, I could use that.
Yeah.
That little thing and then try and incorporate it into my playing.
Sure.
And yeah, so I just love the steel guitar as well. And
so basically, rule one is there are no rules.
That, not copying wise, no.
Yeah.
A thief's a thief.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't matter if it's a guitar lick or a steel lick or a fiddle lick or it's all good.
Yeah.
You know, it licks a lick.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, A note doesn't know what genre it's in or care.
That's true.
Another Telecaster master joined us for episode 56, Mr. Adam Lopez.
My grandmother was probably the closest person I've ever been to, and she's just a huge, huge music fan. So it was always on, you know, it was always in the background and all that kind of thing. As far as specific to the guitar, is probably my Uncle Al. He had a band. He played guitar and sang, and turned me on to, you know, Chuck Berry and Buddy Holly and Elvis and the Beatles and stuff. So, for whatever reason, that was just I saw it and I heard it and I just knew. You know?
And you gravitated towards that.
Yeah, like I never wanted to play anything else. I never experimented with anything else. I just always had a guitar.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think around. What's that?
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I think I'm four or five years old, somebody made the mistake of buying me a drum set, but that disappeared, you know. Maybe within a week or two, it was just gone. I don't know what happened to it.
You should ask them now. I bet you they'll tell you.
Yeah, I think it ended up in Grandma's basement, mysteriously, but the guitar was always there, and it was always what I cared about.
Right.
It's never been an issue of going through different instruments to find the one. It was just, it was always there.
Right. Episode 23, we got together with Kelly Ritchie. She joined us again for episode 54 as well. You're a bit of a gear nut.
Oh my God, my rig has changed. I've spent any inheritance I'm ever going to get. and then some.
Mm-hmm.
My rig, I had this pedal board that was 3 feet long.
Yeah, I remember it.
And 2 feet deep.
Yeah.
And I have a good friend of mine that's been doing some work on my house, and he's a guitar player in a band here in town. And I've been bartering all of the gear for, you know, massive work done here on the house. And finally, the last thing he got was my big pedal board, because I finally accomplished the greatest task that I've ever accomplished. I got my pedal board down to a small size.
I don't believe it.
It's true. I'll tip this up to where you can. Can you see it there?
Oh, I can. Yes. Oh, that's just that's incredible.
Yeah. Now the looper in front of that only used for solo shows,
okay.
So that's out of the equation. And I've got the front part of my rig propped up on two little 2x2 blocks.
Uh huh.
With my looper slid right up to it for a solo show.
Okay.
And then. For a band show, I've just got my volume and my wah, my two tube screamers. And what made this possible was TC Electronics came out with a triple flashback delay. I had their flashback delay, and it was great. And there were three delays in it, but you could only use one at a time.
Okay.
The new triple flashback, you can use all three delays.
Oh, no.
I can't tell you how happy I was. They solved the greatest mystery in life. How do you get, you know, because I love using delays, and
sure.
I love using them in series. And, like, David Gilmour is one of my favorite guitar players, and obviously Hendrix. And, you know, I love the tape sounding delays. I love the ping pong delays. And so I was able to get you know, all three delays on the pedal board. And then Eventide, I had all four of their, like I had their pitch factor.
Mm-hmm.
I had their time factor, which is their delay. I had their space. I did not have the mod. I was getting ready to get that when I realized that they had a small unit that I had overlooked called the H9. And that comes with a sample of all four of those pedals. So those pedals run like $400 or $500 a piece. So this one pedal is just like $500 once,
mm-hmm.
with a sample of everything. And then you can take your iPhone or your iPad and you can go in and you can download any sound library from any of those. So in one pedal, I've got all of the other sounds that I need. And underneath my pedal board, I've got my power supply by Pedal Train. I've got a little Love line drive,
mm-hmm.
and I've got my wireless.
Mm-hmm.
So there it is, all in one. And I can put it in a bag, and I can carry my pedal board now in my right hand and my guitar in my left hand. And my band loves me again, because it took Bam and Freak both to carry that pedal board, and they would just look at me. Like, and I can't imagine what they were saying when I was standing there. And I don't blame them. I got to where my right wrist was starting to be sprained.
Oh, no.
Quite a bit. It was bad. So out of necessity, I had to do something. It was too much to roll, and I'm strong.
All
right. You know, it's like, wow, this is stupid.
Our last clip comes from episode 94. And folks, I could have gone on and on with the amount of guests that we've had on this show. And the great people that I've gotten a chance to talk to over the last 3.5 years. But there just wasn't enough time. This episode's already too long, and many of you are going to complain about it. So our last clip comes from episode 94, where we got to talk to the premier guitar builder probably on the planet, Mr. Paul Reed Smith.
One of the things that I noticed about what you do, And I noticed that it seems that
There is no more important ingredient to a guitar than another. It's all just as important. The nut is as important as the bridge, as the wood, as the pickups, as the wire, the tuning machines. Everything is important. It's like holistic guitar building.
I never said it that way, but it's very close to true. Very close. I mean, I'm positive the jack plate doesn't have as much impact as the bridge, but you're right.
So 30 years ago, was actually more than 30 years ago, really, why does a math major from Maryland drop out of college to build guitars?
Because I hated math. I loved the guitar. And I was good at the guitar stuff. I could see it. I understood it. I liked it. The math stuff gave me a headache. Although I found out last year that guitar making is pure math. And I didn't know that. So math, my son is a mathematician, and he taught me the following thing. Math is taught three ways, numerically, algebraically, and graphically. I'm the graphic guy. I can rotate the guitar part in my head in any dimension and any size in my head and look at it. So I'm looking at it as a math problem graphically. I mean, think about it. You're trying to figure out how to put a truss rod in. You're rotating the entire drawing in your head.
Yeah.
It's pure math, but, you know, for me, that's how it works. I didn't understand. I didn't carry my father's algebraic gene. I had the graphic gene. And my father was a mathematician, and my mother was a math teacher. So I used to have headaches when I was a kid, and there was streams of numbers coming into my head. It was a nightmare. It was awful. I hated it. But now I'm starting to understand that you know, that guitar making is pure three, four, five-dimensional math graphically. And now when we are designing them, we're designing them on SolidWorks, graphic. We can draw a neck in the virtual reality, and it comes out exactly the same as we drew it.
Yeah, you see, and that's one of the things that I was really intrigued about, too, is that you're – it's interesting how, I mean, I don't know if there are other builders doing this, but I think you were probably one of the guys in the forefront. You're using technology to enhance the future of the guitar, but you still have your feet planted in tradition as far as tone and feel.
That's true.
So it's interesting because a lot of people, you know, and I know there's purists out there that are like, oh my goodness, it's a computer and there's not, you know, but when you play...
Oh, wait a minute.
But there are people that are saying
that.
Do
you really write a letter with mimeograph and carbon paper?
I don't.
But... You really want to go back to that? That's not going to work.
No, it certainly wouldn't.
There's a tool to do a job. That's it. It's all it is. It's a tool to do a job. I actually think the brain is digital, but that's another discussion.
Yeah, it's a neural net.
Well, yeah, and it's either on or off, right? So
right.
That's an interesting thought.
Yeah.
But look, this whole idea to use computers. Look, I didn't want to use CNC machinery. There was a meeting in the bar at the Hilton at NAMM, our trade show, and the people from Music Man sat me down, Sterling Ball and the other and Bob Taylor, and they both sat me down and said, "You were going to start using Fidel CNC machinery." I said, "I don't know." He said, "They both said you're going to do it, and that's the end of it." Literally, the peers in my business told me to be the last man. You can't be the last man standing. You've got to do this. So we went and did it. I was told to do it. Now we're doing things in SolidWorks I've never seen. Literally, if I have an artist, we'll send them a computer rendition of the guitar before we ever make a prototype, and they'll approve it from the computer rendition, not from holding it.
Mm-hmm.
Holding it later. Look, the whole idea that computers are a bad idea for guitars, that's insane. Abandoning what all the old masters did, that's insane too.
Well, there you have it. I mean, really, there you have it. 100 episodes, and I wasn't able to get everybody in, and I wish I could have. This is just one of my favorite things to do in the whole world, and there's so many people that I wish I could have had on, like Al Gross from Bottle Cap Rockets, Thank you, Mr. Dave Jennings. The guys from Streetlight Circus, Screaming Effects, you know, Seth Wilk, Adam Steins, all those great people that have been with us from the very beginning. And it was great to have them on, and look forward to having them on again. The guys from Three Wise Monkeys, they're going to be on the show again in the new year. This has been nothing but a trip for me. I love doing this. I love bringing you musicians that you know, and particularly the musicians you don't know, because that's what this show is really all about. I want to thank everybody for listening all over the planet. I'm going to keep bringing this to you. I've got such great stuff planned coming up. Right after this, we've got the Frank Marino episode. It's going to be a two-parter. It's going to blow your mind. And soon after that, a whole bunch of other folks. We're going to keep doing it. In the meantime, take care of each other. Take care of yourselves. Keep on playing, and we'll see you all on the next episode of Guitar Radio Show. Peace.
Everybody say, F you, Ed.
I like this crowd already.
GRS Productions.